Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 6. George Washington Glover. George Washington Glover, the boy of 21, who had companied so well with the little curly-headed Mary at Samuel Baker's wedding, was, curiously enough, true to his promise, or at any rate to a part of it. He did return in 5 years, but whether he had the courage to ask the radiant young person on the edge of 17, whom he found in place of his little playmate of 11, to marry him and was refused, or whether he did not ask her because the whole incident had been long since forgotten, as seems most likely, it is not possible to say. But it was just 5 years after Samuel's wedding in 1832 that George was again a guest in the Baker household. The occasion was Abigail's wedding to Alexander Hamilton Tilton, and George came up with Samuel from Boston to attend the ceremony and join in the great family reunion which marked the occasion. There is no record of his meeting with Mary at this time, or what they thought of each other, and when he said goodbye to her after the great event was over and the guests were departing, it was to go further afield than ever. After Samuel's wedding, he was leaving Concord for Boston. Now he was to leave Boston for Charleston, South Carolina. There is very little in the way of direct record of George Glover, but a clear enough picture of him, more clear than is usually the case, can be had from what there is. The one portrait of him which is preserved shows a young man of about 30, well-groomed in the style of the day, with the inevitable wealth of wavy dark hair, a fine broad brow, a long straight nose, and forceful but not overly determined jaw. It is a portrait which seems to fit in very well with what may be gathered of his character from his few letters, or inferred from what he did. That he was vigorous and enterprising in an age when vigor and enterprise were so essential to success, is clearly shown, if only by the fact that he was ready, at 21, to leave his native Concord for Boston to seek his fortune, and, not content with that, was eager later on to adventure further afield still, into the almost alien land, to a New Englander, of South Carolina. It is, however, in his letters, as is so often the case, that George Glover reveals himself most clearly. One written from Concord, while evidently on a flying visit home from Charleston, is specially interesting. It is addressed to Samuel Baker in Boston. Samuel was then a widower, his wife, George's sister, having died some years previously. Dated Concord, April 20th, 1841, the letter runs along gaily, in a sort of pseudo-sophistication, with the grown-up salutation, "Friend Baker," and a postscript telltale of a young man just finding himself. "Sir, will you visit the South for a wife? If you do, I will present you with a lady, plantation, and 90 Negroes." He states he is in the height of prosperity as a contractor, having just undertaken the construction of 13 houses. Jestingly, he says that if Abby will name her first son for him, I will give him a Negro servant worth 1,000. He extends his respects to all young ladies now in the market and asks to be remembered to your sisters and the rest of the family, Friend Baker. It is a cheery, swaggering kind of letter, pervaded by that badinage and that atmosphere of hail fellow well met, which, from all that can be learned of him, was the essential George Glover. He loved to talk and meet new people. He was a born promoter in the best sense of the word. One of those men who, starting from nothing, would inevitably have made his fortune in a big way if he had had time. He would build and borrow and buy and sell, and at each turn add a little more to his actual capital. He probably always kept at the right side of a forced liquidation, but no doubt the margin of safety was often small, and in order to steer such a business to success, his own personal attention was requisite all the time. Records in Charleston show that the land on which the 13 dwelling houses mentioned in this letter were erected was actually conveyed to him. The probabilities would seem to be that the purchase, as financed by the sale of something else, and that the 13 dwelling houses, when completed, were in turn sold, and the proceeds of the sale immediately reinvested in the purchase of materials to build the cathedral at Haiti, which was his great unfinished enterprise at the time of his early death. Only thus can the fact be accounted for that the equity in his estate, when all claims had been met, was comparatively small. However, his greatest assets were his vigor and enterprise, and these are clearly enough in evidence in his letter. He is at the height of prosperity. As to Mary, the nearest the letter gets to any mention of her is to ask Samuel to convey his, George's, respects to his sisters. And yet, in a curious way, it does shed some light on the course of his courtship, if so it can be called. Among the few papers relating to Glover, preserved among Mrs. Eddy's effects, is a reading of George's character by a phrenologist of Charleston named William P. Hebbard, in the course of which he is described as naturally cheerful and fond of enterprise, yet too cautious to venture much himself. Without, he is sure of success. Below this description, in Mrs. Eddy's handwriting, are the words, "In proof thereof, September 5th, 1841. The presumption seems excusable that George did actually spend the summer, as in his letter he was hoping to do, in the North, with his people at Concord, or even, for a time, at Sandbunton, that the courtship of the two moved slowly forward, as courtships were wont to do in those days in New England, and that, when the time came early in September for George to return for the winter to Charleston, he proposed and was accepted. That Mary was willing to risk an immediate marriage, but that George, with a characteristic final caution, wanted to wait until his position was more secure. Be that as it may, he did return to Charleston with no more than a promise, if that. And a few weeks later, Albert Baker's death had overshadowed all else in Mary's mind. It was a bitter blow, but the girl is just 20, and sickness and bereavement notwithstanding, the joy of living and a vital interest in a thousand things struggle eternally out into the open. Every day life at Sandbutton is quickly resumed. Her friend, Augusta Holmes, now married, not to the disturbing Enoch, but to one Samuel Swayze, a rising attorney in Haverhill, New Hampshire, destined one day to become Speaker of the House of Representatives, is Mary's never-failing resort. She writes to her about everything, moving easily, if somewhat disconcertingly at times, from the most earnest consideration of religion and kindred topics, to the latest marriages and the latest engagements and the latest possibilities among their mutual friends in Sandbutton. In a typical schoolgirlish letter, she rambles on about Miss L. Howard attending a singing school and a dancing school, about Miss Shedd being engaged, about Caroline Dean getting letters from George Merrill, about Miss Delano hurrying preparations for an early marriage. Of these events, she admits she does not know firsthand, and then, rather tardily, she concludes that if everyone would be cautious in reporting flying stories, a great deal less of falsehood would be reported. Then, in other letters, the two girls bandy names back and forth, as girls have always done. There is a Mr. Noyes who has called on Mary, but only to be polite, and a Mr. L. who is incoherent about Diana. Mary asks Augusta to say something nice for her to Mr. Dickey, is more than willing to do what she can towards making cold-hearted man raise his standard of female excellence still higher. But she adds, and this perhaps may, after all, be the true explanation of George's return empty-handed to Charleston, as to my being married, I don't begin to think much of that decisive step. Neither do I intend to be married at present. I am sure I feel as though I should like my liberty a little while longer. Long courtships were very much the rule in New England 100 years ago. The relationship of an engaged couple always had about it an air of limited permanence. It was a transitional stage, of course, but one to be traversed slowly, and all its amenities explored. There is nothing to show that Mary and George were engaged, but that there was some kind of understanding between them, and had been for several years, seems most likely. Their actual marriage, when George returned to Charleston in the fall of 1841, was still more than 2 years away. In those 2 years, if the joy of Mary's life sometimes heightens, the depression often deepens. Keenly appreciative of beauty, wherever she might find it, she is carried up into the seventh heaven by a trip she made with her brother Sullivan through the White Mountains in the summer of 1842. A little journal she kept shows how much she reveled in it all. "The hue of my feelings are painted on all objects," she writes. And then, a little later, showing how inexorably the cloud of ill health overshadowed her outlook, she adds, "Oh, if I felt well, then might I be happy." She found no little comfort and joy in writing poetry, and her poems found a place in the local newspapers and magazines to an increasing extent. She even got as far as Gaudy's Lady's Book, one of the most popular magazines of the day. None of it is great poetry. Many years afterwards, Mrs. Eddy was to write of herself, "From my childhood, I was a verse maker." And this exactly describes these earlier efforts. Nevertheless, in these poems will every now and again appear a line of no little beauty and power, shadowing forth that vigor of expression which was to appear so emphatically later on in her prose. Then there is another picture of Mary about this time, which has its own charm. It is supplied by a certain Martha Philbrick, who, as a little girl in Sandbutton, was taught by Mary in Sunday school. Writing many years afterwards, Martha Philbrick, then Mrs. Weeks, says, "Then we did not have a question book, but I learned a few verses from the Bible, and after repeating them to her, she would explain them to me. She was very pretty to look at. Her cheeks were red, her hair was brown curls, she had beautiful eyes. She wore a crepe moire silk. Her bonnet was white straw and had a pink rose on each side. With her curls, she was just lovely." So one may be sure did George Glover find her when at last he felt himself sure enough and came back to Sandbutton to claim her for his wife. Mary's wedding was a great occasion. Time had wrought many changes since Samuel was married. Old General Pierce was dead, and Grandmother Baker long since, and Albert's death was still a sad memory. The Pierce home at Hillsboro, so long the scene of joyous goings and comings, was closed. And Franklin Pierce, supposedly retired from public life, had removed to Concord, opened spacious offices almost opposite the courthouse. They are still there, much as he used them, and was devoting himself to building up his practice as a circuit lawyer. Mark Baker, grown older, but still erect and emphatic, more militantly religious than ever, has prospered greatly. Already, he is contemplating selling the farm outside the bridge and acquiring one of the most favored homes on the main street. Martha has been married to Luther Pillsbury of Concord a year or more, and Abigail, now a mother, is climbing with her husband, Hamilton Tilton, to new heights of importance. Hamilton is becoming a wealthy man, and Abigail, with that remarkable executive ability which she was later to put to such good purpose, is helping him. And so Mary's wedding was a great occasion. There were, of course, the usual tears, but in all cases, except perhaps one, they were concessions to the demands of the times. The exception was the first Abigail, Mary's mother. All her life, Mary had meant very much to her, but it was not until after Mary married and left home that the full extent of Abigail's devotion is revealed. "Dear child," she writes to her youngest daughter when the two had been separated about 6 months, "your memory is dearer to me than gold. Everything reminds me of you. Do you remember our twilight meeting? It is a precious time for me, for there I feel like meeting with you. And sometimes I fear I worship Mary instead of the great Jehovah. Such a message is poignant and eloquent enough, and throws a vivid light on the character and personality of the young girl who could inspire such devotion in the heart of a woman as poised and possessed as was Abigail Baker. In an earlier letter, full of happy gossip, Abigail presents a picture of the Baker household about this time, and especially of Mary, which outshines in value many pages of description. "And now, Mary," she writes, "I will visit you in your own room, at your fireside with dear George." Is Mary happy? Are her anticipations fulfilled? Are her surroundings pleasant? She answers for Mary, "Yes, dear mother, perfectly." Does Mary muse on her doings back home during the cold of the winter? But things are as always. Martha is sewing. Mahala is braiding. Father sits reading. But they miss Mary's cheerful presence. I look out at the window and say, "How I wish I could see George and Mary coming over the hill." The Mary that emerges as the result of it all is perhaps clear enough at last. In spite of her sickness and her day-by-day questionings, cheerful and helpful, one who uniformly made the best of things and had that in her which made her presence at twilight for her mother a benediction. It was deep winter, 2 weeks before Christmas, that they were married, with snow covering the mountains and deepening in the valleys. The company came in pungs and sleighs and on foot from far and near. Dr. Enoch Corser, Mary's special friend and teacher, performed the ceremony. And when it was over and the last goodbyes said, George and Mary bundled into a sleigh and took the road along the Winnipesaukee River towards Concord, where the first break in the long journey to far-off Charleston was made. Next morning, Mary drove round with her young husband for a last look at her old haunts. They drove over to Bow and up to the old farmstead, past the country school, and down the hill to Pembroke, and then, later on in the day, took the stage to Boston. From Boston, a few days later, they sailed for Charleston. As they were leaving Sanbunton, Abigail Baker handed George a little package. It was carefully sealed and marked with the injunction that it was not to be opened until the two were well on their journey. They had a rough passage, more than usually rough, and Mary was very sick. But as they sailed south, the storm abated, and so it was that they opened the package together. There was no letter inside, only a little book, a copy of Lydia Sigourney's poems, one of which Abigail had marked. It is in Lydia's best style. The Mrs. Hemans of America, as Lydia Sigourney has been well called, has no counterpart today. She belonged to an age that is past, but it is not difficult to believe that her poem conveyed to George all that Abigail wanted to tell him out of the fullness of her heart. A mother yields her gem to thee, on the true breast to sparkle rare. she places 'neath thy household tree the idol of her fondest care, and by trust to be forgiven. When judgment makes in terror wild by all thy treasured hopes of heaven, deal gently with my darling child.'" So runs one of several verses. If the exact meaning is sometimes obscure, its message gains dignity and pathos as coming from Abigail to George. And so, in due time, the spire of St. Michael's in the Queen City of the South rose up all white and glistening out of the blue sea. And before long, the packet was moored to the wharf at Charleston.